there, people. Welcome back to For Real. I'm your host, Kimberly Stewart, and it is my total honor to introduce you to today's episode, a rich, honest conversation with Catherine Wolfe. You know that friend who's both wise and funny? The one who teaches you but still feels like your favorite person to be your real self with, even though you're her student? Catherine Wolfe is that kind of person. I'm telling you guys, she is the author of two absolutely life-pivoting books. They're called Hope Heals and Suffer Strong. She's a national speaker. She's a mom of two and wife to Jay. And she is just someone who continues to teach me so much about what it means to live a life of stubborn faith and unflinching hope. Listen, get your notebook ready because this one is a note taker. And here we go, my conversation with Catherine Wolfe. Catherine Wolfe, I am so honored to have you here. Thank you for taking time in your very busy family and professional life. I am stoked to talk to you.
Oh my gosh, what a blessing to be here. I love it. I loved being in Iowa with you. I treasured that special trip and that time. So I love this. Thank you for having me.
It's a total gift to me. So before we get too far in, for the folks who have not had the honor of meeting you, tell me a little bit about how you spend your days, where you spend your days, and with whom you spend your days.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. My name is Catherine Wolfe and I live in Atlanta, Georgia, and I have two wonderful sons, James and John, who are 14 and 6. And I'm sure we'll get into why there is such a gap between the two kids in a minute. And I'm married to a wonderful man named Jay, and he and I have co-founded a ministry called Hope Heals. And we speak and we write and we have a camp for families with disabilities and just do a lot of cool work in the disability space. I guess we're advocates for disabled people everywhere and have some just really special offerings here in Atlanta, including some forthcoming ones like a respite night and a coffee shop for adults with special needs and some really special things the Lord has opened up for us to advocate for in the Atlanta area.
Awesome. So fantastic. Before we say one more word, Catherine, I have to gush just a little. I'll try to rein it in. I'm not famous for my reining in, but I had the very delightful honor of hearing you in person. As you mentioned, you were in Iowa not too long ago. And
That's right.
I had been semi stalking in the friendliest way for years what you were doing, you and Jay and your work and all the things.
Hysterical.
And I pestered the leadership at my church until they relented and said, okay, yes, we're going to call her today. And they did. And you came.
Oh my gosh. You were so sweet. So you're responsible for me getting there. I love that.
Oh
so
my
cool.
gosh. It was a gift to me to have you there. And last night I looked at a photo that you and I took together. Maybe I'll post that after we release this episode. It looks like I'm clinging to you, physically clinging.
That's hysterical. I doubt that. I'll have to see it, but no, I doubt that.
I was so excited and so moved by all the things you said and who you are. And then I read your books.
So sweet.
I had read parts of your books before, but I returned to them again before we talked today. And I just want you to say writer to writer, your books are phenomenal. They are so beautifully written.
Oh,
every chapter was another wish for a long conversation over coffee and chocolate. And that is a gift that you give to your readers. That's really tough to do. And you and Jay just knocked it out of the park.
You are so kind, Kim.
I am dead stinking serious.
You're so kind, Kim, because you are the actual writer.
No.
We just write a little bit after we had something really bad happen to us. So we never really sought out to be writers. So you're really generous.
I was wondering about that. We're going to get back to your writing in just a minute, but I'm just so grateful you took the time to do it, because I know it costs a person to write a book and it costs her triple to write a second book, because the newness is worn off.
Oh yeah.
So thank you for doing that. For the listeners who have not heard.
Right. For the 99% who have no idea what we're talking about. Totally. Yeah. No,
for those that have not had that great honor, would you mind taking just a couple minutes to tell us your story?
Absolutely. As a 26-year-old young mom out of absolutely nowhere, with no medical history, no family history, no symptoms, nothing, I had a massive brainstem stroke and very nearly died. It was due to an AVM, which is like a really bad aneurysm that I didn't even know that I had. And at 26 years old, it ruptured in my brainstem and caused a massive brainstem stroke. And subsequently, after nearly 2 years of recovery and relearning to eat, speak, walk, absolutely everything, I was able to re-enter the world. And now I am, to this day, extremely disabled. I'm in a wheelchair. I'm blind in one eye. I'm deaf in one ear. I have terrible, terrible double vision because I'm blind, but I see enough to see double, which is really awful. And my hand doesn't work. My face is partially paralyzed. I have tremendous issues swallowing. And yeah, my body is pretty ravaged after the stroke, but I'm here, I'm alive, and I was not supposed to be. So I am living the dream, truly. The Lord left me on this earth, even though science says I shouldn't be here. Yeah. You know, there was pretty much no hope of survival. Because my brainstem had filled with blood, which is usually unsurvivable. And my AVM was actually in the very worst location in the brain. It was actually the largest AVM my doctors had ever seen. And it was only after 16 hours of micro brain surgery that they were able to fully remove the AVM. And it's really cool to say, Kim, honestly, cool is a little bit of a weird word, but it's really powerful to tell you that I always thought for years after the stroke, actually, that I was in this very altered state physically because I was a stroke survivor, that I survived a stroke. So that's why I'm so impaired. But actually, the reason that I'm so impaired is because of the surgeon, the wise, careful surgeon, made the decision to make great sacrifices throughout the surgery in order to sustain my life. So, in other words, had he not really messed up my body lifelong, I would not have lived. And I'm a big believer that if you have a pulse, you have a purpose. And I know the Lord enabled his incredible hands to operate perfectly, even if it really messed up my physical body. As we know, as believers, we are not our bodies. We are our souls. So it's a little irrelevant that my body doesn't work too well. And obviously it works fine because I'm here and I'm doing life, even though it's, you know, it's a little different. I can't drive a car and I cannot walk on my own. I'm in a wheelchair and, you know, I have a number of pretty big issues happening. I can't use one hand. And yet I get everything done I need to get done. And I have a tremendously supportive husband and, you know, life has really gone on, even though it's very different now. And I wish I could say that life has been just wonderful and easy and just beach vacations ever since the stroke. And hardly. It's meant a lot of really hard, hard suffering, actually. The last 13 and a half years have looked like an endless cycle of surgeries and you know, some really tough, bad falls that have left me in emergency rooms time and time again with broken bones. I broke my leg. I tore my ACL and MCL and meniscus. I broke some ribs on another fall. I've really had some bad stuff happen. But in the midst of some really awful stuff, I've been able to biologically have a second child, which is just such a gift. Mm-hmm. And obviously, as I said, we have started this incredible ministry and written books and get to speak and share. So we see just the hand of the Lord throughout our story, even though it's, you know, it's a pretty broken story in many ways.
Yeah. You speak with strength and kind of this perspective that is so hard won. In fact, when you spoke in our church, I had to race out of there to go meet you again at a luncheon where you spoke again. And on my way to the luncheon, my husband called. Mark had been in the room to hear you. And he called crying. And he said, please tell her thank you for coming. And he processed what you said over the next few days and would come back and say, and also, if you talk to her again, will you tell her? He was just blown away, not just about the miraculous piece of your story. And again, folks, if you are listening and you have not read Hope Heals and Suffer Strong, stop this podcast immediately. Pause it. We will be here when you return. Buy the books and go read them. And you write beautifully about all of these things. But the wisdom that's so hard won, I want to tap into all of that, or at least a little of that today.
Boy, you are incredibly kind. And I love that your husband cried. I deeply love male tears. They're my love language. You can make a man cry. It's a good thing.
Totally.
So that's awesome.
Totally. You just are just wise beyond your years, honestly. So I'm not really great at small talk. So we're just going to go there, if you don't mind.
Yeah, please. Oh my goodness. Me either.
Okay, good. Good. We are kindred spirits then. I love how you talk about this. And I also love that you're very honest that you didn't finish the surgery talking about this. This has been a process to come to a point where you can speak the way you do about what you have endured. You went from being 26, a model, an aspiring actress. Jay was finishing law school. You had a little baby. I mean, life was completely and utterly different than what you have as a life now. And so
totally.
I want to know, just start us out. Did you ever, I'm pretty sure that some listeners are asking this question in their own lives right now. Did you ever want to cash in your faith? Did you ever have a moment or a season where you felt like this is mumbo jumbo. It's not real. It's not worth it. It's too hard to follow the way of Jesus. Did you have those times?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. And even more than those times is moments of thinking, I'm not sure I want to stay on earth at all, yeah. Much less following right. Jesus on earth. Yes. I think I'm done. Mm-hmm. But yes, of course, of course, of course. So many times, you know, in my very, very lowest moments, I wondered, A, if God is real, and B, if he is possibly real, which it doesn't feel like, if he made a mistake with my mm-hmm. life, leaving me here. Yeah. And I can remember feeling that God, if he is even real, which I don't know, he's clearly turned his back on me mm-hmm. and forgotten because he left me. I'm between life and death. I don't belong here. He's like not at work in my story. Like, yeah, right. And if this is what serving Jesus with your life looks like, I don't think I want this life. And more than that, thinking like, this is all a mistake. If God is real, he made a mistake here. He can't be trusted. Mm. Really, all those thoughts just swarming. And what was so interesting is even in my very lowest moment when those thoughts really were landing on me, I can remember very vividly a deeper than all those feelings, recognition that everything I've ever thought, believed, understood is so true that it overwhelms these emotions, even in this moment, that somehow God is not only at work here, but I know too well that he doesn't make mistakes. So God did not make a mistake, and somehow he's at work in my story. And I can remember almost like rapid fire making sense of Romans 8:28, that all things work together for the good of those who love him. That Psalm 139 was true, that I've been fearfully and wonderfully made in my mother's womb, which is where the avian was. So we knew all along, no accident there. I can remember feeling that Ephesians 4:1 sense that he's called me to this, that I'm called to live a life worthy of this calling. So I felt, even in my deepest, saddest moments, almost a charge that this is what it looks like to be on the front lines of life with Jesus. And this is sort of my moment. And that feeling has never gone away. It's actually probably been fostered by him through the years, to where I feel very much a calling and a deep sense that by sitting me down in the wheelchair, he was somehow raising me up. And that is just crazy talk. Unless you follow Jesus, you know, the upending, the absolute, complete and total upending of my life, I believe allowed me to fit more perfectly into the upside down kingdom of God. And that is such a gift, that somehow my life being turned upside down made the upside down kingdom more right on for me. And that is just this gift that I can't imagine not living with now. But the reality is, Kim, that it took many years to get that perspective. That the first 5 years, and I say five again and again, so 5 years before I could really even come up for air, before I could talk about it, before I could write about it, before I could even begin to process what God had done. I call it my 5 years in the wilderness of just thinking, how am I going to live my life this way? I'm in my 20s. Like, I have a baby. How can this be my story? And there were just many, many deep low points in recovery of nothing's happening quickly and will it ever return? And some things have, some things haven't, honestly. And and there's been so much sadness and suffering even through this miraculous recovery. And I talk a lot about how it's both and. You know, it's not one note. Things are not just really, really awesome or really terrible. That we can hold both as people, that there's good and hard in our stories. And that tension of joy and sorrow is very real in my story, because there is so much joy, but there is also so much sorrow and sadness and things I'll never do and things that are very hard.
Right.
And I think that's really the human experience of everybody all around feels that way.
This is such an unbelievably refreshing way to talk about sorrow and suffering. And it kind of makes me pukey to think that it's so atypical, particularly in a faith context. I feel like Christians, I mean, you said that when we were together, that Christians are just not knocking it out of the park when it comes to sorrow and suffering and, you know, being able to
exactly
see that.
It's so interesting. Christians are super uncomfortable with sorrow, which is so interesting, because we worship a suffering savior.
The man of sorrows.
Right. Yes, exactly. So it seems almost laughable. However, it's also out of love. We want to make it okay for people we care about. You know, we don't want to think of them as having any sorrow. We want everything to be well with our people we love. Are people we don't even know.
Right.
However, the reality is we're not in heaven, you know, like I love the words of that David Crowder song that earth has no sorrow that heaven won't heal. And the truth is we're not in heaven yet. We're on earth. There is sadness and sorrow. And I believe those can be lifelong. There can be low grade sorrow and sadness in our stories. And of course it is that way. You know, of course there is low grade sadness and sorrow. Horrible things happen in life. You know, your child dies. Do you think you're going to just move on after that? No, of course not. You carry that with you every day for the rest of your life. You know, I read a book called, I think it was called Option B, maybe Plan B, Option B by Sheryl Sandberg, whose husband dropped dead very dramatically. And afterwards, she's one of the CEOs of Facebook with Mark Zuckerberg.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm.
Something like that. And in her book, she talked about people don't move on after tragedy. You know, they move forward and they are able to carry on in life, but you never move on. That's ridiculous. That, of course, when some horrific tragedy happens, there's no moving on. You move forward, but you carry it. And I could not agree more.
Hi, friends. Just a quick break here to let you know about a fun resource we offer our favorite listeners. You are in that group. So you need to head over to KimberlyStewart.com to sign up for my email newsletter. Here is my solemn promise. I will not crowd your inbox. I don't believe in that, and I find it highly irritating in my own life. Second, I will not send you cat videos, ever. And third, I will send you updates on things I love and think you would too, like fantastic giveaways, reading recommendations of what's on my nightstand, and even what I'm wrestling up in my kitchen for all these people who live in my house and never stop eating. In short, my newsletter is what we would cover if we could just all teleport and have coffee together. Our super easy sign up is at KimberlyStewart.com, and we will even send you a free book just for joining in. So come on over. It's a party, and we want you there. And now, back to the conversation. Feel like you're giving license to the human experience that we really, and you're right, it comes from a good place to want to hurry past. In different of seasons of loss in our home and in our marriage, it was astounded sometimes at how quickly people wanted us to just move, and it made them uncomfortable that I was in pain. And so they would point out the weirdest stuff about, you know, how things really weren't that bad. But in doing so, I feel like we're not giving ourselves a present of learning what I can only learn in those moments. You talk about getting bossy with ourselves. I love this idea of Psalm 42:5 when you say,
right, so Psalm 42:5.
Yes, why are you downcast within me? And I would love for you to talk a little bit about that. You had this little part of your talk where you were saying, you know, deeper than our feelings is the truth.
Right. Yeah.
And you said, counterculturally, you said, maybe don't live your truth. And I would love for you to dive into that, because there are so many memes about this and all this, you know, junk on social media about how really you just need to live your truth. And my truth actually is not very great. My truth is pretty much like all over the board. So turn that phrase on its head for us and talk to me about what you have learned about feelings and truth.
I would love to. It's so funny. I don't even remember saying that. It must have been a real throwaway, but I completely subscribe to that. And I'm sure I did say that. So absolutely. Because, Kim, the reality is your truth is changing constantly.
Yes.
Our truth is connected to our feelings in every moment. So I say with great conviction that is stupid.
Yeah.
That living your truth is ridiculous, because living your truth changes all the time, you know? So that's, I understand what people are saying, and that's awesome. However, the reality is living your truth means changing nonstop, because your truth is your feelings, and feelings right. constantly are changing. God's truth is steady and is grounding us to something beyond our momentary truth.
Hmm.
I love that you caught that.
I've thought a lot about that.
I thought that in our current day and age, that's a really valuable commodity, is your truth, or your, honestly, your best life combined with your truth to talk about it. It's right. like one thing. And I love that, because I can say with assurance, I'm living my best life, and that is my truth.
Right.
That's also right. silly, because it's constantly changing.
Right. It's mercurial. It is so up and down. I've got 10 by 10 a.m. If I base, right. if that's not really a good rudder on my ship. So.
Right. Absolutely. And emotions are so valuable. I'm a feeler. So I have all the feels for yeah. sure. And they're Thank important. You. They can be, you know, informants to the soul. Absolutely.
Yes. Good, good.
But the reality is, and this is very countercultural to say, but I'll say it anyway, is we are called to not elevate emotion. We're called to not suppress emotion 100%. We're also called not to elevate it and let it rule our lives. We're much more than our emotions. We are people with full capacity. And, you know, I think many times women get ridden off of, oh, they're so emotional. And the reality is that is a part of a human being experience. Yes, I guess, particularly women in some ways, sometimes. But that's not the whole of a person, is the fact that they're emotional, and it shouldn't be.
Yeah, we talk about that in our house. I know you have a teenager as well. We talk about how emotions are really good information, but they probably right. aren't great dictators of what right. you do next.
Oh, absolutely. They inform and let us know what we're feeling, but we can't let them run the show.
No. Your books and your speaking, I will say, educe a lot of emotion in me. In fact, I have thought more beautiful emotion, the kind that's not just informing, it's actually transformative.
Well, I mean, I'm a hot mess every time I share, so I'm right there with you. I'm always laughing out loud and crying hard.
Oh, I love it.
Pretty much the whole time I'm speaking or sharing, because it evokes deep emotion for yeah. sure. And it should. And I don't apologize right. for that. I heard years ago a quote, I can't remember it now, but basically, never apologize for feeling life. That shows you're awake. You're yes. tuned in to yep. what's going on. Don't apologize for that. It means you care.
Absolutely. We don't want you to phone it in.
Right.
When you were speaking, you showed, this is in your book, and also when you were speaking, you showed a photo that just about wrecked me.
Yeah.
It was your first Mother's Day.
Yes, yes.
I've seen this multiple times, but I cry every time because there you are with your little baby in the hospital for number one, first Mother's Day, the time when you're supposed to be, yes, in bed getting pancakes, and you are not getting pancakes. And you're like,
right. No, yeah, no, nothing peroral for almost a year, actually. So definitely not. But much more than the sadness of not eating food was, of course, the deep sadness of that little baby. And it is tragic to say that I have no memory of that yeah. day, that first Mother's Day and many more days I have no memory whatsoever of. I was in a coma-like state, and I regained memory after about 2.5 months. And once I did, I was conscious again. I began in this like bizarre Groundhog Day sensation of like not being able to remember the day before, so obsessively asking the same questions yeah. over and over in my head, at least, of, you know, someone would bring James in the room to see me, and I would think, oh, today's the day that the baby comes to live with me in the hospital because he's my baby. So I'll keep him here and I'll figure out a way to modestly breastfeed and take care of him. And he'll live with me, which is so messed up because I was in no state to care for him. Mm-hmm. But I think that maternal instinct is so deep that I'm like, oh, my baby, I've got to take care of him. And it would be months actually before I could process that I could no longer take care of him. Mm-hmm. And that I would need friends and family to jump in and care for him. And it was very, very sad. You know, there's been a lot of sadness and just deep suffering when I had the stroke. But that may be the very worst, was not being able to take care of your baby and feeling like you're not a mother. And it was really just very spiritually complex to understand what is God doing. Yeah. You know, you have this horrible thing happen and you think you get a pass to where this terrible thing happened, but now everything's going to be okay. Mm. And the reality is that isn't how life is. You can go through the ringer again and again and again. You know, there's no quota on suffering. That there can be suffering and more suffering and more suffering in this life. And it is terribly painful to recognize that, but there is a freedom in that recognition that let's change the baseline here. The baseline is not everything is okay. And that when you can kind of latch on to that, it does change your perspective. I will say, as a 26-year-old, I did not remotely understand that. You know, nothing bad, quote unquote, had ever happened to me.
Right.
So, of course, I wasn't recognizing that suffering will be deep and ongoing in my story.
Right.
But the reality is, if you live long enough, you understand that. You know, you don't talk to many 80-year-olds who don't understand. Life is very painful. There is hard chapters and seasons. Mm-hmm. The reality is, when very, very hard things happen, especially at a young age, they inform the rest of your life. They inform the way you live the rest of your days. And that is a powerful gift.
You write about having to learn things you did not have on your radar. And one of the scenes in one of your books is about how you were making cupcakes for Jay.
Yes.
And you were using what you call your crazy right hand.
Yes.
You write about tying your strong hand literally behind your back, tying it down.
Right.
So that you forced your right hand, your less able hand, to do something hard, and how there's this intentional pain for profit, pain with a purpose. And I don't want to make you my Yoda, Catherine, but I feel like you've earned a voice at this table, and I would love weigh in. I just love for you to weigh in. Does pain have a purpose? Does all pain have a purpose?
I absolutely love that you're asking me about that. Actually, you're very astute, Kim, to have pulled that out, because what you're talking about is the phenomenon that they used in my occupational therapy all the time, called hand constraint therapy, which they would tie my quote unquote good hand that worked behind my back and force me to use my right hand that would not work, that has no fine motor coordination, thus creating new neural pathways for the brain to work with this hand that no longer worked. And even the words hand constraint therapy are so powerful to me, because in all of our lives, whatever our constraints are, perhaps those constraints can be avenues to flourishing if we have eyes to see it that way. That what is holding us back actually enables something else to work. It's really a beautiful word picture that by tying the left hand back, it forced me to use the right hand. That constraints can force us to grow somewhere else in our story. And that is tremendously valuable.
Oh, and a pain in the tusher. again.
Right. Yes. Oh my gosh. Absolutely. It was awful. Making those cupcakes and 10,000 other things are awful. And yet it enabled my hand to semi work. It is a grade, but I do have the ability to grip with this hand, and you know, it's not still, it's always moving, but, you know, it works much better than it would have had they not done that therapy.
How about that? I'd love to ask you a couple questions about writing specifically.
Absolutely.
I can tell you love words. You love beautifully crafted words. I was looking for like some particular thing last night. And even in my paging, you quote Dorothy Sayers and Dostoevsky and Chesterton. And we've talked about our shared love of Sarah Groves and her rich.
Oh, I love Sarah Groves so much.
I can tell you love words and your writing is so beautiful and true. And I want to know, did you always have a dream to be a writer?
Absolutely not.
You didn't?
Oh my gosh, no. Most definitely no. My mom is a writer. My husband is a writer. I'm decidedly not a writer.
Oh, I disagree.
But oh my goodness. But what I do have is a deep desire to communicate truth. And for instance, with Sarah Groves. Oh, I mean, she's a writer. The lyrics of her music are
unparalleled.
Absolutely. Yes. It is so shocking to me. I don't know if you know this, Kim. She comes to our camp, Hope Hills Camp. She's a dear friend, and she comes from Minnesota to rural Alabama and performs for our campers.
I love it.
And it is life-changing for all involved, because I mean, the Sarah Groves is giving private concerts to these parents.
And I love that.
I get to look them in the eye and say, you're worth it. You are worth this extreme talent from Minnesota getting in front of you. That you know, her song Open My Hands really changed my life. And would you want me to quote the beginning? I do love it.
I would love for you to quote it. Yes, please.
The opening lyrics of Open My Hands. She writes, I believe in a blessing I don't understand. I've seen rain fall on the wicked and the just. Rain is no measure of his faithfulness. He withholds no good thing from us. And I got chills. It's hard to even process her ability to process and write words like that, because that's all of our cry, isn't it? How can Psalm 84:11 be true? He withholds no good thing. And yet, perhaps we're looking at it all wrong. Perhaps it's not about the good, quote unquote, good life as we understand it. Sarah and those lyrics, that song, and in conversations with her, led me to a recognition that the true goodness of God is not connected to anything in the physical world, that the true best things of God, the truly good, are the peace, the joy, the comfort of Him in the midst, the assurance of what's to come one day, that is actually the good stuff, and that all the rest is never good to begin with. So if it gets taken, that's not God's good stuff being taken.
That wasn't on the list.
Yeah. And that's pretty life-changing, paradigm shifting stuff. She's a genius. So I'm glad you pointed her out.
Well, I have to tell you again, I'm going to disagree with you that you say you're not the writer, because those words that you just said are crafted beautifully to help communicate big truths in small pieces. And that's, I think, one of your gifts. I have another question about writing and speaking.
Yeah, no, totally.
How do you know when you're ready? Bob Goff and I do some writing coaching together, and we have lots of folks who have hard stories and things they've walked through, and some are presently walking through these hard things. And often these writers will say to me, when do I write about this? How do I know I'm ready to write about this life-altering or soul-shifting experience? How do you know when you're ready to put those things to paper? Mm-hmm. Do you have any wisdom that you can share with me?
Yeah, I have a lot to say about that. You know, through our family camp, we have families around the country coming to rural Alabama with, you know, pretty much all around blown up lives. Disability of all kinds equals life. Life's got some major struggles. And so many people ask, when should we write a book? Should we write a book? Should we start today? And we always say, no. Actually, people are so quick to want to respond with a book or talk about it publicly or, you know, help to make sense of it. And I hear right. that. I want to make sense of my pain and struggle. However, there is such wisdom in giving stuff a moment, you know, is taking time to adjust to this new normal before you write about it. And I, for me, and I don't think this was a moment too late, it was over 7 years after the stroke, almost eight, that we wrote the book. And, you know, it's a year-long process, so really between year 7 and 8. And that was a really good amount of time because we kind of knew some of the arc of the story. Actually, our book one, Hope Heals, ends with me having John, the second baby. Had we written it a moment before that, the ending of our book wouldn't have been in the picture yet.
Right.
So I think, you know, you kind of got to get through the hardest seasons before you turn around and try to talk about them yet. But I do say, with that said, there is something very powerful about things that aren't perfect yet, sharing right. from that place, which I have the luxury of doing every day. But, you know, I didn't have a car wreck and, you know, bounce back the next day. Or I guess a better example is I didn't have a stroke and then walk out of the hospital and live to tell. You know, I'm coping lifelong with all of the issues that from the stroke, from the AVM rupture, I should say. And there's beauty in that too, that sharing from the broken place for sure.
And you're still learning, right? I mean, you didn't.
100%.
You were writing yes. more than one book, and you probably speak differently today than you did 6 months ago. I mean, that's a beautiful piece too. It's not a static experience that you talk about and then the period's at the end of the sentence and you never revisit it again. So giving yourself the license totally. To say this is still a work in progress. It's not done.
100%. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
I wonder if you could coach us a little bit on a very, very practical thing that lots of listeners are encountering every day. And that is how to have empathy instead of wariness and fear when we interact with folks of different abilities.
Oh, for sure.
I think there's a lot of pullback because we don't know what to say. We think we're going to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing. And I would love for you to speak into that. In your book, you say the best sentences are, I want to know your story. Can you help me know you?
Right.
Which I think it just kicks down all sorts of walls between us. But tell us how to come alongside folks in their stories and their situations that feel too big or too hard.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have tons to say about this. One, to the person listening who is carrying so much from a person to person living in this world, there has to be a way to empathize truly and deeply, but not fully internalize the pain and take it on and think about it before you go to bed at night. And I call it the ability to empathize, but not internalize. And I do think that is key. With that said, to be able to truly empathize, I think it is all about asking questions without making assumptions. So curiosity without assumption is so important to honestly, appropriately don't assume, but ask, and ask kindly, and ask, I want to know your story. What is it? And be very forthright. You know, people really, really will forget so much of what you say, but they will not forget how you make them feel. And even if you're botching your way through everything, looking people in the eye and caring about them carries tremendous weight with people. They want to share their story.
Beautiful coaching. Beautiful. We need to know how to do that. And I feel like lots of folks just don't enter in for fear of doing the wrong thing. Oh, for sure.
Well, also, what is so sad to me is in this super fast-paced world, we don't see each other anymore. You know, it's a tragedy. You know, I'm on my phone and I'm in a hurry and I don't even notice the disabled lady in the wheelchair. I don't even see her because I might glance where my eyes go, which isn't down. Or, you know, I'm on my phone. I don't see the homeless person outside of the grocery store in need of a conversation. Nothing. I don't see the lady who checked me out at the grocery store for that matter. I don't see anybody in the world, much less look them in the eye and dignify them as a human being.
You posted recently how I love how you do this in your real life. Said that in the grocery. Yeah, tell us that story for folks who didn't see that about how you walk through the grocery line.
Oh, you're so funny. Folks who didn't see that, you're right. But yeah, I will be happy to share. Pretty much for the past several years, and I think it started early in the pandemic. Remember how there was like this real question of going to the grocery store, like for the first few weeks even, and should we go, or what, are they going to show up to work, and what's that?
Totally.
So anytime I would go to the grocery store, as I'm checking out, I would always either point to the area right by the cash register, all the treats there, or hold up a handful of treats. I'd grab a few and hold one up and say, hey, which one's your favorite here? Or, hey, out of that shelf right there, what would you pick for a treat? And have them give me their recommendation. Then whatever they say, which no one's ever said, I don't know, everyone has a favorite treat. Then I grab it, acting like it's for me, pay for it, and then hand it to the cashier and say, hey, on your break, I want you to enjoy this. And while you enjoy it, I want you to know that it means so much that you showed up for work today and you're doing a great job. I loved getting to have this moment. Thank you for checking me out today. And inevitably, I mean, tears, like totally. Shock. I mean, I've probably done this, I mean, a whole lot in the last few years, like every time I've gone to the grocery store, which is a ton. I've never had anyone say no. No one has ever said, nope, sorry, not interested. Every single person has taken the treat. Most have cried, looked completely shocked. I mean, one lady one time was like, I have to call my husband and tell them this happened to me.
Oh, okay. I just love it.
And I'm like,
I just love it.
I love it so much. It is. And what it does, Kim, and this is why everybody in America needs to do this, is it changed my brain. It changed how I feel about my life as I leave the grocery store. It is doing nothing but that beautiful truth of 2 Corinthians 1, that I am comforting others with the comfort that I have received. And when I'm comforting, I'm filled with comfort. It's a beautiful cycle. And I just think it's so the way to live. If nothing else, if you cannot afford that 79-cent candy bar they wanted, look them in the eye and say, thank you for being at work today. Let's live that way. Let's dignify people with how we live. You know, it's really not
A few minutes, you see someone. In just a few minutes, you didn't have to write a program or a curriculum or start build a new logo. No. It's just a couple minutes.
Yeah.
I think it's awesome. Thank you so much for that fantastic idea. I'm going to let you go. But before I do, I need to ask you a couple questions that I ask all of the folks with whom I speak on this thing.
Absolutely.
They are book nerd questions.
For sure.
So part one, what's a book that you return to over and over to recommend to other people. So it could be a really old book or one that you read recently, something that you like to say, oh man, you would love this book. And you've mentioned a few during this conversation. We'll have all the links to all of those things.
You know, I have to say, a book I read as a 12-year-old girl has stuck with me my whole life. It's The Hiding Place by Corrie Ten Boom. It's totally a classic, and could not recommend that enough. You know, when we moved to Atlanta from Los Angeles, we were having to live in an Airbnb before we could move into our house. And the Airbnb was absolutely terrible. The air conditioning went out, and it's August in Atlanta. Oh. Like, if it could go wrong, it went wrong. The bed broke. Our 3-year-old is like, not okay. I mean, it was just so rough.
It's just so horrible.
And I downloaded The Hiding Place on Audible, and I started listening to it for perspective of, yeah, right, please, what a joke. I could be in a concentration camp. Like, please, this is almost ludicrous to compare, but what it did was entirely change my perspective instantly. And when Corrie wrote about, have you read it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Oh, of course. It's a beautiful book.
So Corrie wrote about that she could not thank God for the fleas that had infested the concentration camp hut. And she, like months later, because her sister Betsy wanted her to thank God for the fleas, then she said no.
No, that's my limit.
Yep, exactly. A month later, she came to find out that the reason the male guards were not coming into their bunk was because they did not want to get fleas. So it was literally keeping the male guards away, A, so they could have their Bible study whenever they wanted, but B, the male guards could very possibly have done terrible things to those women.
Right.
So it protected them. And I found myself thanking God the air conditioning went out. I have no idea what this means, but somehow I trust you, Lord, that this does not make sense. But I'm grateful because this is, for some reason, what you have for me in this moment.
Oh, great recommendation. We will link to all of these things in our show notes. Part B, last question. What's a book you're excited to read in the very near future? Anything on your nightstand?
Ooh, are you kidding me? Like 8,000 things on my nightstand that I like desperately need to read like yesterday.
There's a part in your book where Jay says you have an actual bookshelf of the books you've read and then an aspirational one. And I identify with that. Things that if I have more time, I really want to be reading. Yeah, totally.
Right. No. It's a problem, Kim, to say the least. Like, there's so many books that I want to read, but I have not completely, gotten to, let's just say that.
Totally get it. Yeah.
I would say a book that I really want to read that I have not read is the Beth Moore book, the one that's the novel, Chasing Vines.
Yes.
Do you know of it?
Yes, but like, I haven't read it yet.
I haven't either. And I want to. I'm like, wait, Beth Moore novel? I'm interested, but I haven't gotten to it yet. Let's see, what others are good ones that I really want to read? Do you know who Kate Bowler is?
Heard her speak. Have you? I haven't read anything from her yet, but are you okay?
I read her first book, and her second book, No Cure for Being Human, just came out, and I haven't read it, but I really want to. Her first book, Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies, I Believe, was so good. And I can't wait to read No Cure for Being Human. I'm a big Kate Bowler fan. So that's probably a good one. Another one is John Mark Comer, Live No Lies. I've started it, but haven't finished it. And I love him. And I definitely want to read that one as well. Anyway, that's a few. There are many, many more that are on the list.
Oh, good. Those are just absolutely home runs, all of them. So thank you for sharing those recommendations.
Oh, yeah.
Catherine, I just want to thank you for joining me today. I've been learning recently about how in the history of Judaism, the idea of wilderness is different than how we look at it. And that their idea of wilderness, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, but from what I'm gathering, the wilderness was a place where you met God. And then the question was always, how do you take the wilderness with you? as opposed to my instinct, which is always, how do I get out of here as fast as I can? And I think you are a beautiful example of meeting God in the wilderness and then taking that wilderness with you. I just am so grateful.
You're so sweet to say that. I love that picture. I love that thought. Wow.
Well, you are a beautiful example to me of how to do that. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for living it and writing about it and speaking about it in total honesty and vulnerability. You are a gift. People, if you are hearing the voice that I am saying right now, pick up everything this woman has written. You will be ever the richer. So thank you, Catherine.
You are so kind, Kim. Thank you for having me.
This was one of my very favorite conversations I have had ever. And I felt the same way after I heard Catherine speak. Don't you just feel like you have met a friend that changes everything and who will wear that gravity while still being game to like bake cookies and watch a movie with you? Good grief, what a woman. Listen, if this episode hit you where you live, will you forward it on to someone you love? I feel like we're in a moment where we could all use a shot of courage and hope mixed with the kind of honest faith that Catherine is living so beautifully. So forward it on. Rate, review, subscribe, all the things so that conversations like these can get into ears and the hearts of folks who are really thirsty for them. Thank you for hanging out with us today. Come back soon, and just know we will have the door wide open for you, for real.